Hello there, it's Gina Gardner here and welcome to Thriving Not Surviving. Today I am joined by a very, very special guest and I'm extremely excited. Samantha Lazelle is a great friend and she's someone that I've wanted to come on the show and I'm really thrilled to have you here today. So thank you so much.
Thank you for inviting me.
Our pleasure. Now, I'm going to, as always, read the bio because I don't want to miss any of the real juice in the bio because it's a really interesting one. Samantha Lazelle is an experienced yoga teacher and yoga studio owner. She also teaches not only yoga, but teaches people to teach yoga. She's well known for her calming vibe and advocacy of self-compassion as a superpower. Samantha's journey of self-discovery through her personal adversity has blessed her with the ability to transmute difficulty and trauma into authentic love. Her powerful blend of yoga and meditation practices act as a catalyst for compassionate transformation in the lives of her students, and I can vouch for that. Samantha says, "I strongly believe when we practice yoga, we're practicing self-compassion. Beginning our practice by sending loving kindness to ourselves softens our expectations on the mat, and in this softening, our inner critic quietens, and we can begin to accept ourselves as the beautiful, unique, and powerful beings that we truly are." That's a really powerful message, and one that I'd like us to get into. Okay, so please share with us the journey. How did you get here?
Well, thank you for inviting me onto the show. It's really wonderful to be able to share something of my story. So the journey to where I am now has been long and scenic. There's been many twists and turns and places where I wasn't quite sure where I was meant to be. I've had several careers along the way, none of which made sense cumulatively until I stand back now looking at the journey in the rearview mirror, and it all makes a lot more sense. So when I left school, I suppose, is a good starting position, or maybe even before then, I suppose, is probably a good place to start from my personal journey. I grew up in a difficult household, where there was a lot of difficulty in expressing emotions and giving yourself permission to be who you were. So it was an abusive environment where a lot of the time I hid myself, my true nature, and guarded it very carefully. Now that later on became a habit, which was difficult to break. So it took me a long time to get to a point where I realized the worth of my true nature. Through all of this, I had made the decision very early on to love no matter what. That was sort of the kernel of truth that I managed to shield, that I managed to keep hold of in amongst all of the maelstrom of difficulty that was going on, was that love was the answer. And I was very sure of that. I don't know why, but that was the message that I had and that kept me going. So then as we fast forward towards time of leaving school and leaving home and lots of decisions that made no sense to me that I made. I went into an engineering apprenticeship. I ended up doing office work, all sorts of different careers. I worked in the city for quite a long time, in the legal sector, working with big international law firms, providing operational support for them. None of which speaks to what I do now. And it became clear to me at some point that what I was sharing in my personal life and what I was experiencing in my personal life of this loving kindness being the answer to people's situations. When I was one-on-one with people, when I was talking to people who I was managing, or I was talking to people in other companies, or I was talking to my friends, I was having these conversations, and every time the thing that was the most useful to apply was loving kindness, was this idea that compassion, coming from a place of true compassion, that sort of motion towards wanting to help people, having empathy and then wanting to step into their shoes and understand their difficulties, was the answer to so many of the things I was experiencing. And so, although I had always practiced yoga on and off, and I'd done lots of other things as well, it became really present to me that yoga had something about it that kept drawing me back. And so I decided to spend some more time there. So although I was having some personal difficulties at the time, I decided to take an extended break from work and dive into yoga. And so when I took that journey and spent time really being with that, and the initial part of it was to heal myself, was to spend time looking at what was happening in my life, looking at how to heal not only my own but my family's situation, and how that would expand, and how what I learned I could help them with, it became more and more clear to me that this was my path, and that everything I'd learned up until that point was actually the preamble, and it had given me all of these skills that would enable me to reach a wider audience with what I had learned. And so I find myself here, having practiced a lot of self-compassion to enable me to move past really difficult traumatic events in my life that I've seen other people really trapped within. Mm-hmm. And that can become so self-destructive. And the trauma stays with you, but stays very real and close to you. Whereas allowing, and I have done a lot of work in softening its grip on me and being able to move through it and past it and into something that never leaves it quite behind, but that is more skillful and helpful, and gives me the space to be what I choose to be rather than be what the trauma informed. I hope that's an answer that helps.
I think, and it is, and I think many people listening to this who have been through difficult childhoods, whether they were abusive or not, I think, you know, one of the things is that we all have a blueprint of how we should be loved when we're children. And for many people, whilst from the outside it would not be seen as abusive, I'm not suggesting that, I mean, yours was extremely so, but for many people, even what seems like an ordinary childhood can feel out of sorts for them. And I wonder, what advice have you got for people who, as adults, look back on their childhood and are struggling? You know, you talked about people being trapped, and I know from the many people I've worked with that many people are trapped and they don't even talk about it for decades. So they can't actually start to work on it and move on. Is there any advice you'd give people who are in that place?
Well, everybody's situation can be so individual. And as you say, it can be that from the outside, a lot of the questions they're asking themselves is, why do I think it was wrong? Why didn't it give me what I needed? Why am I feeling that something isn't right, that I haven't had some sort of foundation that I feel I need? And I suppose my general advice would be, it's never too late to change how you're living. It's never too late to change your thought processes, to begin that healing journey. However long you've sat with what you're experiencing, it's never too late to learn to be more skillful in handling it and to make decisions that can really bring peace and true love for yourself. because so often in these situations, we blame ourselves for it. Because as children, we have that message that if I'm not being loved, it's because I'm unlovable.
Yeah.
And reprogramming ourselves to actually take that step of loving ourselves first is probably the most, the first and the most useful thing that, that I learned to do. And I'm so thankful that I, that that was a lesson that came up for me and really held me. And I practice it all the time. And anytime I feel that my inner critic is becoming harsher, I notice it because I've been doing that work for such a long time now. I notice it quite quickly. And it's always self-compassion, self-love, and that reminder. So it's never too late to do the work.
Thank you. Isn't it interesting how when we hear harsh words from someone else, they're difficult to hear. Mm. But when they're harsh words to ourselves, how they have so much more power to wound and destroy, don't they?
Oh, definitely. Well, we know all our soft spots, don't we?
Yes. We do.
We know all the places where it's going to wound and skillfully wound in ways that other people could never learn.
Yeah.
Even if they'd spent 30, 40 years with us, our inner critic is always the most skillful at doing that. But I've learnt over the time that when my inner critic is being particularly vocal, mm-hmm. And not only vocal but quite unkind, when something's happening that's promoting that voice to a prominent position,
yeah,
it's an indicator, it's a flag that something's not right. Now, it might have absolutely nothing to do with whatever's being spoken by my inner critic, but it is a signal that something's out of balance. Right. So although listening to the actual words is very rarely helpful, the sentiment and the sense of urgency around it and that sense of energetic danger is useful as a barometer of actually what's balanced and what isn't balanced, I personally have found.
And certainly I think that that feels right for me and for many of the people I've worked with too. I'd like to move on, if I may, in terms of initially you talked about yoga was something that really helped you heal you and how now you're using it to help other people. For those who are not, have never tried yoga, can you talk us through how yoga can help, what it is it about this as a form of self-treatment, self-love?
Sure. Well, I think most of us, whether we've experienced yoga or not, will have a perspective on what we think yoga is. So we'll have that idea, maybe we've seen some images, or maybe we've heard some sounds. There might be some idea that it's about a pretzel shape or being able to stand on your head. Or you know, some sort of Indian music or being able to levitate or whatever, yeah. Whatever that sort of the word brings up for people. That's very little to do with the yoga that I practice, apart from me being connected to the source. I did train in India. The yoga that I practice and teach is much more about delving into who you are. The asana, the postures, are 1/8 of the system of yoga overall. So there's a lot more to it than being able to put your foot behind your head. and in fact, which is great, there's very few people that can do that. It wouldn't be a very widely useful system if it was all based around your ability to do that. So what yoga teaches us, in whatever form we practice it, whether it's in a meditation or whether in a focused concentration, there's one of the eighths of yoga is self-study. So really learning about yourself. However we approach it, whichever limb of yoga we go down and we use, it's having a conversation with yourself and enjoying the journey of it without the expectation that there will be a goal at the end of it. Mm-hmm. So if I give you one of the postures, for example, because that's usually what people connect with yoga, that's how they think of yoga. So say we have a posture, a one-legged balance. Yeah, say it's a standing balance and it's on one leg. Well, to begin with, that might be quite challenging for people. And they may get disheartened if they try it, they can't stand on one leg. They're like, well, that's not for me. So the yogic approach would be, can you stand on two legs? You can. That's amazing. You're almost there.
Yeah.
So the journey of discovery, yeah, and then maybe putting weight onto one leg whilst keeping both feet on the floor. You know, are you able to do that? Amazing. You're almost there. And learning that actually along the way, there the journey is so important. As with any kind of spiritual work, any kind of work we do on ourselves that we participate in, we learn the most on the journey. The goal is to learn about yourself, not necessarily to be able to stand on one foot. So in having those experiences, can you transfer that into other areas of your life? So when something comes up that's difficult for you, is your first response, I can't do it, that's not for me?
Yeah.
In which case, learning how to bring in some more resilience on the mat and learning, take it step by step, do the things you can, learn a little bit more about the next step, see if you can do that, can be transferred into many other places in our lives. So it's really life training.
Yes.
It's very little to do with the actual pose and more to do with your approach to the pose.
It's a really interesting way of looking at it. And I have to say, the first time I ever heard that as an approach and an understanding of the underpinning principles of yoga was when we spoke about it. And I think that would be very helpful for many people who, you know, see somebody with their foot behind their head and think, you know, I can see a bad back and strained ligaments coming, and so I can't do that. What I'm interested in perhaps exploring is, whilst you're doing that, is that one of the messages that comes through very strongly is self-compassion and self-kindness. And, you know, I'm not very physical, as you know. I have real struggles with my physicality. And yet the principles of what you teach in the meditations and so on really resonate and are really helpful. It seems to me that this is applicable to anybody.
Absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. And I think people get put off by this idea that you have to be flexible to do yoga.
Yeah.
You have to already be a yogi to be able to do yoga. Well, that's almost impossible. Unless you've been a gymnast or a dancer, how would you possibly be able to do that?
Yeah.
I mean, we often talk, my business partner and I talk about, you know, the difference between a beginner and an intermediate yogi. What's the difference? You know, it's nothing to do with a pose. It's nothing to do with a particular level of practice. The easiest way to sum it up is, if you are in a yoga class and everyone else around you is in a pose that you can't do today for whatever reason,
yep,
that pose isn't accessible for you that day, and you're okay with that, you're an intermediate yogi.
Right. Yeah. So it's really interesting, isn't it? I mean, a lot of the teachings that I talk about are, everything starts with your mindset, your thoughts, your approach to life, your beliefs, and yeah, it's being mirrored here, isn't it, in terms of yoga.
Absolutely. And I've taught people who have had strokes. I used to teach in a nursing home, a convalescent home, for stroke rehab, and people who were in bed, unable to get out of bed.
Yes.
And we did group meditations, we did pranayama, breathing techniques, and they would come by choice every week. Mm. And what a beautiful way of being able to share yoga, to say to them, it includes you. You're welcome here.
Yeah.
This is also for you. There's benefit here. And I know of people who work in all areas of healthcare, end of life care, you know, children's yoga, senior yoga, where the posture and that idea that we have of yoga maybe because of Instagram, you know, that the yogi on one leg on top of a mountain is so far from what our experience of yoga is. It would be wonderful to have that be more buoyant in society, for people to understand that it is an inclusive system, and that anybody, you know, start where you are. That's the most important thing. Accept where you are, begin where you are. There's always something that you can do. And yoga gives you a path. It gives you a system within which to work. And so there is discipline and there is challenge within it, but it's at your pace and with a guide. There are many people who have walked that path before you, of varying ways, varying styles, varying traditions, varying abilities. And so there's something in it for everybody. I think that's
And that brings me to a really exciting part in terms of your career, in that you opened up Same Star Yoga Studio and you started to teach teachers. And so to pass on the capacity to share this with others. Do you want to just give us a brief outline of that?
Sure. So we are in the middle, actually, at the moment, of our first program of teacher training. And it's been something that Faye, Richie's who I run the studio with, and I have been wanting to do for quite some time, to be able to give people that long container for exploration of themselves. And that's what our course is called, Exploration of the Self. And it's a little different from a lot of teacher trainings. So a lot of teacher trainings, you have a particular style of yoga that you practice and that you like, and you want to become a teacher in that. And so you go to an expert of that, and then they teach you how to do what they do.
Yeah.
So quite simple. You learn how to do what they do. And then at the end of it, you're qualified in that particular style. And then you go off and do that.
Yep. And you then go and start your own classes up with your own students.
And then you do that. And some people who are students of a particular style want to deepen their practice, and they'll do the teacher training. They might not become a teacher in it, but it's that style. It's that thing. Whereas for Faye and I, because we're both multi-style trained, we our teacher training offers four different styles of yoga. So our students experience all of those throughout the course. So we teach the traditions that we are steeped in and connected to. And out of that blend, each of the students finds their own way. Mm-hmm. So each of the journeys will be unique depending on what resonates with them. I'm more of my tradition is more Buddhist, whereas Faye's tradition is more Hindu. And so that comes through in the philosophy and the teachings. And so as they move through the course, the trainees have the opportunity to explore what these things bring up for them.
Okay.
So if you're somebody who has always done very active yoga, and that's the kind of yoga you would like to teach, yes, and you really enjoy that, the movement and the energy it creates, how much more challenging to sit in a class where you need to hold a pose for 5 minutes?
Yeah.
That's going to be bringing up some things for you that you would never have explored if you only stick to your style.
But isn't that what people do all the time? They stick to what they know because it feels comfortable and safe.
And there's the word. Yes. That word, comfortable, very much. One of the big things about yoga for me, and over the years I have experienced very high levels of anxiety, and lived with OCD, and have had a diagnosis of PTSD, which obviously brings up a lot of different modalities of feelings and anxieties. And what I have found is that yoga has taught me to be comfortable within the discomfort. The discomfort isn't going to go away.
No.
Yeah. I'm going to feel anxious about things. That's my go-to emotion. rather than trying to push it away, which is the instinct, I don't want it, I don't want to feel like this, and of course then it gets bigger and bigger and bigger and it becomes everything. Rather than pushing it away, the best advice I had from one of my meditation teachers was, how would it feel to put your arm around your anxiety? Rather than pushing it away, how would it feel? How would it feel different if you put your arm around your anxiety and asked it to sit down with you and talk to you as a friend? And it changed everything.
I'm sure it did. It's a very powerful way to look at anxiety. Mm. And it's your anxiety is a message. It's trying to say to you, I don't feel safe.
Yes,
and often that's a perception and not the reality. And when you sit down and talk with it, then you can help put things into perspective, can't you?
But of course, it feels very uncomfortable to begin with. That discomfort is a big thing for people. And no one wants to be in the discomfort. We do so many things in life to get rid of that discomfort. And well, I know I have also.
I was going to say to you, often rather than getting rid of it, what we do is bury it. And rather like a dragon in a box, the least sign that the lid is being opened and the dragon comes out and breathes fire and gets bigger and bigger, because we're using all of that energy to keep it stuck. I'm going to have you back on the show because we're running out of time. And what I want to do before we finish is, how can people find you? And if they're not in the UK, you know, what are the things that you can share with them? Because you have such a wealth of knowledge and your energy is truly inspiring.
Well, thank you, Gina. People can visit our website, which is samestaryoga.com. And we are at the moment in this situation we find ourselves in, teaching online. So you can access our classes from anywhere in the world. And we are carrying on with our group classes. We are a teacher training program. We have some little spaces left for October. And we're hoping to offer components of that online next year. So for anybody who wants to stay in touch with us, do subscribe to our newsletter. And all of the news goes out on there. We have a Facebook page. We have an Instagram feed, all Same Star Yoga. And it would be great to connect with you there. And learn a little more about you, wherever you are in the world, and share some of this compassion, this self-compassion, and put more of that out into the world.
We certainly need it. Thank you so much. Really appreciate it. And as I say, we'll have to have you back on the show, particularly when some of your developments come through for next year.
Absolutely.
Now, don't go away. We've got a short break. And then after the break, we've got a genuine chat with Rachel and I. And looking forward to seeing you then. So see you in a minute. Thank you.
Imagine being a highly successful, enlightened leader who is in complete alignment with your best self, who makes a positive difference on a daily basis. Let me introduce Gina Gardner, an expert in developing transformational leadership with over 30 years of experience. Gina has developed a unique and unrivaled approach to help you step into your genuine power to become an enlightened leader. And when you do, amazing things happen. Go to enlightenedleadership.co or email Gina at gina@genuinely-you.com. Thriving, not surviving, with your host, Gina Gardner. To lead others, you first need to be the best version of yourself and lead from a place of wholeness. Motivation, empowerment, leadership, personal and spiritual development are just a few of the topics you will hear on Thriving, not surviving. So sit back and enjoy the show with your host, Gina Gardner.
Hello there, and welcome back. Now, you know in this part of the show that I'm joined by my good friend Rachel Davidson, both of us international authors. Rachel, a great novelist. She has a trilogy. If you've not read it, I really recommend that you read it, Beyond the Veils. And all of my books and hers are available on Amazon and on my website. Now, it's interesting that I start off by talking about books because the theme today is about the power of words.
A good one, isn't it?
It's amazing, isn't it? What a difference our words make. So, first of all, the tone of our voice makes such a lot of difference. So, oh, thank you. Thank you for being on my other radio show yesterday.
Oh, you're welcome.
Thank you for rubbing my nose in it that you've got a cup of tea and I haven't.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Tone makes all the difference. But yeah. Really, we're going to dive into the power of the word itself.
Yes, because in actual fact, as you've said, the actual words you use are a very, very tiny amount of the communication, the passing of meaning when you have conversations, aren't they? So much more is about the body language and the tone and the context and so on and so forth. But nevertheless, we're going to concentrate on the words themselves, yeah.
So I want to explore with you, so our listeners and our watchers get a real understanding of when you use words mindfully rather than unconsciously, how they can have such a different power. Mm-hmm. Most of us don't think about the words that we use too much. Well, let's qualify that. When we are in a good mood and things are going well, we tend to think about what we're saying. But when we're triggered by something that has happened or something somebody else has said, then we often go into automatic responses and we use words. Very often it's in those times when the words are at their most challenging and potentially damaging. Mm. So when you're cross with your child or your partner and you turn around and talk to them, you stupid thing, mm-hmm. or horrible person, mm-hmm. when you're attacking that person, it's very different to using the words, well, that was a stupid thing to do and I expect more of you, mm. or, well, I don't expect you to be horrid, what's going on? Mm. So you attack the behavior and not the person. So there are lots of situations where the adjustment of a word or two can make all the difference. This needs to be better. This needs to be even better. Mm. What does the difference in those two mean to you when I say those?
Well, I mean, the first one is that you're given the impression that there's nothing good with it. It needs to be better. And in the second instance, the small addition of the word even means that, you know, it has some merits and it has, if you add some further, it'll be better. So, I mean, you know, as a writer, well, I don't have the ability to give any intonation or body language with the words I write. So you can get a little bit sort of, you know, tied up and twisted about use of words and in the moment of writing them. But generally speaking, going back and editing, you know, the selection of this word versus that word, you know, it's such a difficult, you're always trying to strive for the quickest, most effective, most powerful way of getting across your meaning. And certainly in my earlier careers, I played around with lots of deliciously, you know, I was like a kid in a sweet shop, delicious words that aren't necessarily in modern day parlance, let's say, and I had a great deal of fun with that, but as I have got more word weary, so to speak, as I have written more and more, then slowly again I come back down to the power of just normal words, really, and how in combination with those around them, you can still make a very, very powerful statement, convey emotion, convey all of the necessary imagination that you want your reader to have with actually very few words. And I think that's an interesting part of the writing craft, really. Because there are writers out there who are extremely poetic. John Donohue, for instance. I think he's more poet than he is prose writer. But nevertheless, his books are prose and they're beautiful. But when you sort of, when you sort of break it down, what he's actually doing, he's not using five syllable words all the time. It's his combination of the words. The other thing I would say is that some people, and society in general, actually, they transfer the word, the meaning of a word, whether it be a good meaning or a bad meaning. So you and I are always talking about the word should. I feel very sorry for the word should. Oh. It's not a bad word. But in modern day, because a lot of, I don't know which self-help guru first said it, but this new sort of thing of, if you're saying I should to yourself, then it's probably the wrong thing. You shouldn't say should. Oh, I shouldn't say should. And if you look at the actual word itself, it's not that hard. It's not harmful.
No.
But of course, we come back to this point that if you attach a particular meaning, if the peer group you're in has that sort of definition of that word, that's what it now comes to mean.
It's interesting because the word should, must, need. I often challenge clients when they're talking about something that they know that if they do whatever it is, or they be whatever we're talking about, that's that they feel they ought's another one, that they ought to. It's the difference between, eating a carrot is so much more healthy. Actually, what I really want is a donut. So I ought to, I should, I need to eat the carrot.
Yeah.
But what I really, really want is the donut.
Yeah. But I mean, as you worked your language there, you started with the ought and the should, which is generally speaking, looked down upon, and then you move to I need to. Well, that's not generally looked down upon, is it? But it has exactly the same meaning as ought and should. Exactly, in the you look it up in the dictionary. Again, it's these fashions that come and go. Like crone is another good example of a word that has a very negative meaning in today's world. In fact, you were in the same meeting as I a while back where the word crone was used, and the person using it meant it in its original honouring of elderly female wisdom. And back in the day when you had a croning, it was a celebration. Okay, it wasn't a bad thing. And then the word has got slowly morphed for sort of power and political reasons. So now if you're called a crone, you're expected to be highly insulted by us. And indeed one woman did stand up and start saying, "You can't use the word crone." Even though the person using it was trying to explain the very point I've just made, which is, these words are not bad. In fact, actually what's bad about them is how society has taken it and used it against. And there are some really sort of dangerous words in our vocabulary that, you and I as white women, we couldn't use particular words and get away with it at all because we don't have the racial background, we don't have the economic background, yeah? So
it's interesting, isn't it? Because in different parts of society at different times, certain words to describe other groups of people have been seen as perfectly acceptable.
Yeah, and there are certain words that those people pull back.
But I think they are acceptable.
Yeah.
We need to make that very clear. But just in terms of how through time words change, the word nice initially used to mean silly.
But I did not know that, Gina. It meant silly.
Initially, according to the research that I'd done, the word nice meant that you were being silly. But now, nice, it's a very, very bland word in terms of something that's slightly pleasant and almost dumbed down. But I suspect at one point it meant much more. But I think what you were talking about, particularly around the crone and, you know, the listening to words, is two things. Firstly, what we say is not what necessarily what people hear.
Yeah.
And that one of the things that has struck me over the years is that I talk the language of Gina, you talk the language of Rachel. And because we know one another, we have come to an accommodation where we have a shared language, where we both understand one another because we know each other well. But I work with many clients who are in relationships either with their significant other or boss, for example, where it's as if one person is talking bananas and the other person is talking grapefruit, using the same words, but actually with a very different meaning. The language gets very complicated in the sense that what you say isn't what people hear, that we have different meanings and different values behind those words. And if you don't talk about that, then you assume that your blueprint for that word is the same as everybody else's. And of course, it isn't. But also, it's the intention behind those words, isn't it? In terms of your language to other people, but also the language to yourself, that makes a huge difference. So I think, you know, when people are listening to this or watching this, to start to be really mindful about the language you use. The other thing I want to pick up is the complexity of language and how you used to love playing with words which perhaps weren't in common usage. And I'm reminded when I was a principal of a school, I would get the school reports in, and very often with young teachers, teachers who spoke perfectly normally, their writing would become so convoluted and complicated that you couldn't find the meaning of it. And I'd say to them, why? Well, it's a report. It needs to be have gravitas. And getting across to them that simple means there's less opportunity for people to misinterpret, to misunderstand.
Yeah.
It's quite an interesting concept, and it happens so frequently.
Yeah.
And I think the same is true of, you know, governments and of official language, that they want it to sound important. They're very puffed up importance, they make it almost unintelligible for people to understand.
That's why I love reading legal documents, actually. I mean, love is probably too strong a word, but because it's almost the opposite end of that, in that legal documents are trying to be exactly clear, and in trying to make it utterly clear what is and isn't included in said contract or whatever, they often feel like, you know, squiggly little mazes that you're chasing around the place and going back on yourself and whatever. But and that always intrigues me, the manner in which a legal document will be written and versus what a layman would do.
Yeah.
So sometimes complexity is most definitely needed.
Yes.
But generally speaking, yeah.
If you're trying to get across a complex idea and to cover all your bases and make sure there's no loopholes, I can understand that. But I think, you know, we're reaching towards the end of our conversation today. I'd just like to recap for those of you listening. Be mindful about the words that you use and the intention behind them. And that remember that you've got two ears and one mouth for a very good reason. Check that what has landed is what you intended. That if you're talking to people and you're being critical, then be mindful. Criticize the behavior, not the people. Because when you criticize the behavior, then that's very wounding, and you are most likely to be your most critical critic. That's not very good language, is it? That you're most likely to be the most critical of you. So be careful of the language that you use to yourself inside your head. And I would say,
very much understood what you'd said, Gina.
Great. Check back that people do understand. But also recognize that the language that you use can make a difference. Every word that you use leaves a living legacy. And you can choose whether that legacy is positive, neutral, or negative. And so do it consciously. I'm not saying do it consciously to hurt. Please don't do that. Find a way that you can get your point across without having to be negative and detrimental to somebody.
Well, my mother always used to say, if you haven't got anything nice to say, probably best not to say anything at all. So there's that option, isn't there? Just don't say anything.
So want to leave you with that. Please go and check our books out. Rachel's novels, Beyond the Veil, Rachel Davidson, all of my books, and there are many. Go on to Amazon, look for Gina Gardner, and you will find them. You'll find them all on the website, genuinely-you.com. Thanks so much for joining us. We look forward to seeing you in the next BBS show and Genuine Conversation. Bye-bye now.
If you're a businesswoman who is overwhelmed or suffering from imposter syndrome, who is tired of having one disastrous relationship after another, or who finds it hard just to say no, well, it's time to take care of you. You get the best out of life by contacting Gina Gardner, relationship coach and best-selling author and motivational speaker. Just visit genuinely-you.com, or you can email Gina directly at gina@genuinely-you.com. Take action now. Start to thrive rather than simply survive.